Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Lara Romans, and I'm here with our producer, Elliot Bloom, to talk about some new releases in cinema right now. We're talking about Benny Safdie's sports biopic, The Smashing Machine, the re-release of Back to the Future, and the Palme d'Or winner, It Was Just an Accident. Before we begin, I'd love to share some cool things that are going on in the coming weeks here at Lab 111 in Amsterdam. If you love a classic, you're in the right place because we're celebrating the American New Wave movement, which means you can see classics like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Taxi Driver, The Godfather, Network, and many others. There's tons of other fun stuff going on, so you can find the full program at lab111.nl. But first, Elliot, what have you been watching lately?
Great question, Laura. I watched The House of Dynamite yesterday by Kathryn Bigelow.
I watched it yesterday, too.
Wow. Yeah. But you watched it at home.
I watched it at home because they have the craziest release window for that. It's like a two-week streaming release window.
It's more fun to watch on the big screen.
But yeah, please watch things on the big screen.
But anyway, it's by Kathryn Bigelow, and it's basically set within 17 minutes of what happens if a nuclear warhead is heading towards America, let's say, and what are the consequences, how do people react,
and they don't know the origin of the
launch. That's important also to mention. As I said, it's set within 17 minutes, so how does a two-hour film stretch this? And I think usually we see films condense time, whereas here it's really trying to stretch time, and unfortunately that's probably the biggest issue with it, because we see the same 17 minutes play out three times
from different perspectives, and you only gain a little bit more information where it's like, cool, now we know this guy has a wife. Let's hear the same conversation again.
So the first act I really enjoyed, and then it did start to get a bit too repetitive, but I have to say I wasn't I watched this hungover, and I felt quite emotionally vulnerable in this film. I was almost crying at some points. There's a point where like a regular officer is calling his mom to tell him that he loves her. And I was just like, yeah, I love my mom too. I wish I could call her.
I mean, for me, it was depressing in another sense that it's like, oh my God, look at this government with competent people.
that actually care about a conscience
and empathy. And oh my God, like, wouldn't that be nice? So yeah, that it was depressing in that regard.
Yeah.
I only mildly enjoyed it.
I thought
the first like 20 minutes were really strong. It's like, what's going to happen? Oh my God. And then it's like, oh, we're just going to hear the same conversation seven times from different perspectives.
Through different people's Zoom connection. Almost.
It's like, oh, she has children and he has a pregnant wife. Now I feel more empathy. It's like, okay, I get it. It was mid. It's a good hangover movie, I guess, because I was in the same situation, except I was on the couch with a bag of chips.
But what did you watch other than The House of Dynamite?
I basically, for Halloween, I made a big list of horror movies, and we've just been going through them, and we just had so many that I'm just still like watching so many horror movies. And we basically made a list that's like scary, not scary, because I don't like movies like The Conjuring or Annabelle, or the ones that are like really scary, like just like make me
just like gore.
It's so hard to put my finger on what it is, because I actually really like gore. I just don't like the ones that I think Kermit and Mayo always call it quiet, quiet bang. And that's the only point of the movie, is that you're just going to sit there and be like, okay, boo, boo. So I don't like those. So we've been watching things like Drag Me to Hell or Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, yeah.
Things that are very like fun and stupid. We've been watching Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, like all of those. So I think that's a really fun genre to play with in the darker months, and to find movies that fit that bill.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, it's kind of goofy. It's not actually scary, but it's a little bit scary. It's like, so I really like that genre. I should make a list. I should make a public Letterboxd list.
Is there one you would particularly recommend or shout out?
Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah.
I loved it. I'd never seen it before. It was one of those that was always on the list. And I'm really glad I watched it. It's so goofy.
Yeah.
It's so like, it's Joss Whedon, so it's very like Buffy coded.
Yeah, but it's like peak 2010s America, high school kind of vibe, or college years.
And there's so many like little jokes in there that are so funny. I really, really like that one.
Yeah, nice.
Cool, but yeah, what else have we been watching? A lot of new releases. The Smashing Machine was a big one. We also saw it together. I didn't know you were in the room.
Oh, yeah.
When I watched it.
Yeah, because you were at the back.
Yeah, I was at the back, and I was
So basically, we go to a lot of press screenings, and Elliot always shows up 5 minutes late. So you always just kind of like sneak in while the movie's already started. So I didn't know you were in there. And then we again did the thing where.
But I kind of like watching it. Usually, we sometimes sit together if I'm on time. But I think it's better.
It's better. Okay, let's just agree now that we're never talk to each other ever in public. We don't know each other. Good. If you see us in the same room, don't feel weird that we're not talking to each other. We only talk on the podcast.
Yeah.
Okay, so The Smashing Machine. Benny Safdie shows us a very different side of Dwayne The Rock Johnson as MMA fighting legend Mark Kerr. He's one of the pioneers of the sport, which, to be fair, I didn't really know anything about going into this. But Mark Kerr is someone who shines in the ring, but at home he struggles with substance abuse, the struggle and the pressure to be great, and his complicated relationship with his partner, played by Emily Blunt. Here's a clip.
I really want to go on the ride with her, but I have a sensitive stomach. Is there the center part in there? That's the thing that stays still, right? Can I stand in there, in the middle part?
In the center part?
Yes.
No, that'd be a serious liability issue.
Well, where would you recommend I stand then? Because I don't want to get sick on the ride, but I do want to ride with her.
You don't want to get sick on the ride? I would suggest you don't go on the ride. If you can't handle it.
Okay. Well, it's not that I can't handle it. It's just I'm choosing not to go on.
Okay, I'm going to go on the ride. You're going to hold my cake? Hold my bag.
Okay.
Okay.
Should we do this thing again?
We should do the thing again. Okay.
I'm guessing what we think of the
film.
What
I think is we probably both rated it 3 stars.
Close. Yeah.
Close.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think I would give it 2.5 stars.
Okay. Fair.
But I'm curious because I thought maybe you might have vibed with it a little bit more. But
I have my Letterboxd open here. I think I gave it 3.5.
Yeah, I think I would have said
I gave it 3.5. I gave it 3.5. And that is because I fucking love Benny Safdie. I love Benny Safdie. I think he's a weird little guy. You can tell that he's the guy who works with Nathan Fielder and made The Curse and things like I like almost every choice that he makes in this.
Interesting.
It's kind of goofy. I just don't think it really worked. Because I don't give a shit about the UFC. And it's one of those things where, like, you can also just not do this. Like, you're doing these fighting and fighting is really hard and you're beating people up and you're getting beat up and it really hurts. You could also just stay home and not do that. I always feel this way about rock climbing movies as well. You know, the documentaries about like a white man with a hobby and he wants to go rock climbing and it's so hard and they interview his wife and they're scared that he's going to die. And I'm like, you could just stay home on the couch. This is a self-created problem. So I do not care about it. That's kind of how I felt about this movie. It's like, I'm supposed to be feeling really, really bad for this guy. I'm just, just stay home and don't beat people up. Don't get beat up. Like, it's not that hard.
I completely get your point.
I mean, there were other issues with it and we'll get to them, but...
Do you like Rocky? That's a good question. Is Rocky kind of thing? Okay.
Not for me.
Anyway, you can make these films about sports or things that you have no interest in, but if the heart of the story is good or you're trying to show something, then it's going to work. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem with this film was I didn't really know what Benny Safdie is trying to show me. Like, the film is billed as like... Mark Kerr's character is someone who can't lose. He can't deal with losing.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, he eventually loses. Big shock. But then I was like, so what? He hasn't learned really anything about it. I haven't learned anything. And it just felt like Benny Safdie didn't really know what he was trying to show or say and was more trying to perhaps he likes Mark Kerr as a person. Or
I guess because it is all based on a true story. So it is this guy, Mark Kerr, I did not know about him.
So the whole thing is that now you have MMA and UFC, which is a particular fighting division within America, which is now this multi-billion dollar sport. And Benny Safdie perhaps sees Mark Kerr as someone who's forgotten about in the early years of how the sport became so popular. And okay, but
could have been an email.
Yeah.
Did you know that Mark Kerr founded this stuff? Oh shit, no way.
Exactly.
I think the problems are mostly with the script. What I mean when I say I like every choice that he makes, I mean, as a director, I like the choices that he makes with... it is just hilarious seeing Dwayne The Rock Johnson in this part where he's supposed to be really strong and he's constantly complaining about that his tummy hurts.
Yeah.
And like those little things, those like little Benny Safdie-isms, I really, really enjoyed. And the way that things are shot and the way conversations happen almost has this kind of like Nathan Fielder-y sense to it, which I thought was, they could have gone weirder on, because I think I said to a colleague in the beginning, I was like, man, I hope this is going to get weird because he's a weird guy. What did you think of The Rock?
He was fine. Like, he did well. His performance and Emily Blunt's performance weren't really any issues for me. I think they both carry it well. I think, though, I would now like to see The Rock do a serious role that isn't tied to his physique or character and see if he can carry a film like that. But my issues, again, was more with the script. Like, for instance, I got really, really tired of Benny Safdie telling me every single thought that Mark Kerr was thinking or how he was feeling. Like, it really gave nothing to the imagination for the audience. And, like, to sort of back this up, within the first few minutes, you see I think it's like an opioid bottle on the bed. And it's like a faraway shot. But then he comes into this extreme close-up just so you can see that it says...
exactly what it says. Yeah, that it's highly addictive. Yeah.
And then, like, throughout the film, it's like Mark Kerr's on the plane and he asks someone, can you lift up that plane window so I can see the sunset? And so then you can
I thought that was hilarious. But that's what I mean. It's like that tonally for me, because I wrote down that specific moment where I was like, I think... people are going to think this is cringe, but I get what he's doing because it's weird. Like, the delivery is weird. Everything about it is just weird. And I think we talked about this before. Have you seen The Curse?
No.
You should watch The Curse. It's great. But if it's that tone of like, I don't think people are going to understand what he's trying to do here.
Yeah.
But that, I was cracking up with that. It's like, okay, you put up the, wait, I want to see the sunset. Oh my God. I loved that. What I really liked is that at some point you actually forget that you're watching The Rock.
Yeah.
Because
Until he shaves his head and then
turns back into The Rock. But so basically he has like pretty heavy like prosthetic makeup on, but it doesn't look weird in a sense. Like at some point you just forget that you're watching a guy that underneath has these like flared nostrils and is that guy that you know from all the movies where he wears like a safari shirt and he's in the jungle. I thought it was a great way to kind of like put him in a different position. And I think he really delivered.
Yeah.
I think Emily Blunt was a terrible miscast.
Mm.
And I think, I think she did a good job.
Let's
just say that she gave it her all. I just think she is as a person kind of too put together and British.
Yeah. Sure.
Kind of, that it almost felt like cultural appropriation that she's wearing these like chunky coffin shaped French tips and she's trying to be this like American kind of like trailer trash.
Yeah.
You could tell that she was like making a meal out of it.
Yeah.
She's like, watch me do this character now. Yeah. And I could never really believe her as that character because we know who Emily Blunt is. She's Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
You know, she's that. She's not this like Anora type.
Yeah. I also did have a bit of an issue with how Safdie treated character of Mark Kerr compared to Mark Kerr's wife. We're encouraged to feel a lot more sympathy for Mark Kerr rather than the wife. And then she has this, like, let's say a mental episode near the end. And there we're sort of trying to see it from Mark Kerr's perspective too much, or more how he's there to then look after her or something. And then he puts her in a police car and then still flies off to...
and does a fight.
Yeah. And I was like, that's... I'm sure that probably happened in real life, but we should be able to understand that's a really weird thing to do to show how committed you are to not wanting to lose, that you leave your wife in the middle of a very intense mental health crisis. So yeah, there was just two, and then like Mark Kerr cries at some point and we feel more sympathy for him, even though he's in this pattern of very destructive behavior.
Yeah. Cause the scene where he cries is also shot very wide and you're like very removed from it. Yeah. And I don't know. I didn't really mind those choices as much, because what I do wonder is, because Mark Kerr is also involved in the movie, he just kind of like shows up at the end as like a little like epilogue, that I wonder if there was any influence on those choices. I'm sure if that happened, then it's honest enough to show that he was being a big old asshole when his wife was like having a mental episode. If the filmmaker believes that showing you that is enough to make your own judgment.
Yeah.
To be like, geez, what a fucking asshole. He's going to fly off to Japan and do a fight while his wife is literally in a police car right now.
Like, very.
So it's kind of like a juxtaposition between like, oh, it really over-explains everything to you, but also maybe sometimes it wants you to just judge for yourself that this is a horrible thing to do.
Yeah, I don't know.
But yeah, generally, I thought it was enjoyable to watch. I think a big influence on that is also the needle drop that I've now been annoyingly singing around the house. Remember that song, Just Another Day by John Cicada?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They go to the fun fair and it's like, I don't want to find another way. It's such a good song. And I think last year I had a big like hyper focus on that song where I was playing that for like weeks on end.
Funny.
So I was like, oh man, that's a great needle drop. I don't know. I just had quite a bit of fun with it, but I don't think it's going to stick with me.
No.
And I think there's a lot of things that could have been better about it.
I was also thinking, because I was reading a bit about the film, that this got a 15-minute standing ovation at Venice
that
Film
Festival.
That doesn't
mean shit.
No,
someone can get up on stage and eat a Subway sandwich and get a 15-minute standing ovation at Cannes. Like, I will no longer read those headlines. This got a 6-minute standing ovation, so that means it's bad. No, like, I don't... That's arbitrary. Also, we should just have a set amount of clapping, and we should just let it be decided by how hard people clap.
Yeah, it should only have to be a couple of minutes. But I'm thinking, are they paying people just to stand up after and clap? Because I've never clapped 15 minutes in my life.
I think it's just a social experiment of like, when is this crowd gonna give up? Like, is like, there's always gonna be one guy that's just gonna like keep clapping, and everyone's like looking at the guests, like, oh, I guess we also, because otherwise we seem disrespectful, and we want to be respectful because Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson is in the room. Like, I don't know, I don't buy it.
Do you think they have someone there with their stopwatch ready to go and count as soon as someone starts counting?
Oh yeah,
but,
so they can make it into a Variety headline.
Yeah,
no,
I really want to see the Safdies back together and see what they make
well
again.
Yeah, so that is also interesting because Josh Safdie is also doing a weird sports biopic later in this year. In December, it's Marty Supreme, and that's about ping pong. So they're both doing niche sport biopics separately. I am interested in seeing what they do separately, kind of like with the Coen brothers, where you see like, oh, okay, so Ethan Coen is shit at making movies and Joel Coen is good at making movies, but they need each other. I'm kind of interested to see what happens when you take these two apart to see what they do. So, yeah, I don't know what Marty Supreme is going to do. But, yeah, generally, it wasn't a complete miss for me, but also, yeah, okay. Again, I do believe that Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson will get an Oscar nomination for this. I do think so. I could see it. I just think he's such a huge, like, he's, like, the biggest actor in the world for some reason. And I think it is interesting to see him in this role. I do think he's going to probably get a nom for this.
Yeah, I hope he doesn't win. I don't think...
No, I don't think he deserves to win at all. But I do think that's probably, looking at the year, that's probably what's going to happen.
Yeah, I just wish Benny Safdie had a clearer idea of what he was trying to get across.
Yeah, what the message is.
And that would have helped structure the film and guide the audience because... Like, he's not a bad filmmaker at all. You could definitely see he also is good on his own, but I think needs a story to get into that.
He needs a really, really strong script, and then he can put his like little fun
weird,
sauce
quirky,
of like a quirk over it. But yeah, I think that's what was lacking.
Yeah.
On to one that has been proven by the test of time: Back to the Future.
Oh my gosh.
So Back to the Future is back in theaters for its 40th anniversary. So it's a great reason to revisit the classic by Robert Zemeckis. You've probably seen it before, but regardless, here is a clip.
Jesus Christ, Doc, you disintegrated Einstein.
Calm down, Marty. I didn't disintegrate anything. The molecular structure of both Einstein and the car are completely intact.
Where the hell are they?
The appropriate question is, when the hell are they? You see, Einstein has just become the world's first time traveler. I sent him into the future.
I rewatched Back to the Future again yesterday.
Yeah.
I think this is one of the movies that I've watched most in my life. I'm just a child of this era that not necessarily Spielberg directed, but Spielberg produced, like obviously like Gremlins and then all those Spielberg directed ones, and this is also produced by Spielberg. Like, just that era of the 80s is just completely in my DNA. So it's fun that we're doing this.
When did it come out exactly? 85,
yeah.
Do you remember how old you were the first time you watched this?
I just feel like it's always been a part of my life. I feel like this is probably a movie that I would have watched when I was barely conscious. So like 3 years ago. No, I just think this was always part of my household. I think my parents love this movie. Yeah. It's just one of those that I will watch every like 3 years or something. What's your relationship to this
movie? It's probably, it's also a film I love, and it's probably a film, what maybe a, one of the few films I've watched the most as well, simply because it was always this film that would always be on TV on like a Sunday afternoon. And it's just so fun and easy to get into and so warm. It's almost like a hug, but in a very fun, upbeat kind of way that for me, obviously not from the 80s, but still like you very much love the world that it creates. And then the character itself, Marty, it's very relatable, I think, in that sense. And I think
is it relatable though? For like, I keep thinking about this. There's also a John Mulaney bit about this, but if you really look at it, it is the story of a 17-year-old kid. His friend is a disgraced nuclear physicist who is probably like 100 years old.
Yeah,
that's not explained. We don't get any explanation on this. Then he builds a time machine. They go back in time where his mom tries to fuck him. And he then has to try to get his dad to fuck him so he doesn't die. And then in the meantime...
You mean sleep with his mom, not him.
Exactly. So like, this is... It is fun to look at this through the lens of like time travel rules because I love that shit. And that's why I will never get along with Christopher Nolan. But...
He's always catching
it is
strokes.
Fun, but I think the last thing it is relatable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, more Margie's character. I think just this dorky guy that can't get anything right and then goes back into a time where he's considered the cool kid.
Yeah, the cool
it's
kid.
Something that we all hope or wish or like.
Yeah, you
want
to be one of an old time machine and go back? What year would you go back to?
Good question. 60s, I think.
60s.
Yeah. Mm. You?
I was literally talking about this with my partner yesterday when we watched that. I would go back to the 90s because I think the 90s is a time that I lived through as a kid. And as a kid, it was so fun. But I don't think I fully got to appreciate as an adult
how fun it was.
How good that time was. Like, geopolitically, there wasn't really a lot of stuff going on. And just like everything was colorful. Yeah. And like supermarkets had animatronics for some reason. Like, I think I'd go back to the 90s.
But why do you think this film has stood the test of time?
Yeah, I do think it's that like teenage experience. I do think it's just an incredibly well-made movie.
Yeah.
All the little details. It's just such a fun movie to pause and just kind of like see what's going on in the background. So for example, it starts out in this town and Marty's in this town and it's like, save the clock tower because the town is completely run down. And then you pause the movie and you see that like the movie theater is playing like porn. Let's say it's like, oh, it's playing Orgy American Style. And there's a ton of graffiti on the walls. And if you pause, like the graffiti is hilarious. And all these like little details. The way that in the first like dinner table scene, they plant all of these little things that come back later. It's just an incredibly well-made movie that's like short enough to keep your attention span. A lot of stuff happens. It's wacky as hell. I don't know what exactly it is about. What do you think it is?
Was it, just to check, was it a blockbuster hit from the moment it was released?
Oh, I'm not entirely sure. I think so. Yeah, it was a huge box office success because the first one had a budget of $19 million.
Oh.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And it made $388
million
worldwide. So that's a big old blockbuster. And then in total, the whole franchise is good for like almost $1 billion. So.
Whoa, because there's three films?
There's three of them.
Yeah. Why do I think it has done so well? I think it's just a very accessible, clear film that is fun. Like you go
it's
there
for
to
the
have
whole
a good
family.
Time. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a great family movie. It has a good time and it doesn't take itself too seriously.
I say it's for the whole family. There's two rape scenes in it.
Oh, yeah.
But also it can show your children that rape is bad.
Yeah, and incest.
But yeah, again, the little details, another note that I made is like when he's in current time, the mall's called Twin Pines. And then he goes back in time, he like hits one of the pines with his car and then he goes back into normal time and then the mall's called Single Pine or what's it called? Lone Pine.
Funny.
It's like all these little details. What I also want to talk about is... the 80s or Steven Spielberg's obsession with Rube Goldberg machines.
Explained.
So you know how it starts on basically this machine that will like feed the dog. It's this thing and a ball rolls down and then that shoots a lever that turns this thing around, that opens a can, that's in Gremlins, yeah. That's in this one. I really feel like that's like an 80s. Obviously, Home Alone has a lot of those kind of.
Yeah.
So he's like, what was that all about? Everybody fucking loved a Rube Goldberg machine back in the 80s. It's just something I wanted to point out. Yeah, there's a couple little goofs in it. So, for example, when he goes, the titular, back to the future from the past, Doc Brown is like, you have to start driving at this exact second because the lightning's going to hit and then this and then the, and then you're going to get the whatever gigawatts or something needed to get back to the future. But there's a goof because like his car doesn't start initially. So it's like, so did Doc Brown miscalculate? Mm. Like all these, like there are a couple of like little goofs. Also, there's this whole side plot with the Libyan terrorists.
Yeah.
The plutonium. Yeah. And I'm like, maybe we could have lost that. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. That just feels weird now. But yeah, it is just such a lovely movie to rewatch over and over and over again. I'm really glad it's back on the big screen.
Yeah. I mean, this would be my first time watching it on the big screen.
Oh, yeah. I think I've seen it before. I think Lab has screened it before.
Oh, really?
It's super fun. So go see it if you haven't seen it in a while, or especially if you've never seen it before.
Yes, please.
So then we have Jafar Panahi's It Was Just an Accident, which won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. The title refers to a family driving down a dark rural road and hitting a dog, leading the car to break down. It was just an accident, says the wife to her husband, and it leads them to a local garage. Once they get there, a mechanic named Vahid hears the driver and is convinced that this is the one-legged intelligence officer who tortured him years ago in prison. So he abducts the driver and plans to bury him alive, but suddenly he's not sure whether he has the right guy. He then goes on a journey to verify this guy's identity by talking to others who have memories from their time in prison. Here's a clip.
حق داره بدونه چرا گرفتیمش.
نه بابا. قشر خاکستری هم بالاخره زبون وا کرد. اینقدر حرف نزدی ببینی باده داره از کدوم ور میاد بپری تو باد. عیزه به.
Elliot, I don't think you've seen this one.
No, sadly not. But you have.
I have. It's a great watch. I'm really glad it won the Palme d'Or because I think a seal of approval like that will get as many people as possible to go see it. I think it's a very important film, especially when you zoom out to see how it was made. So Jafar Panahi is an Iranian filmmaker who has been arrested before for propaganda against the regime, which means he was sentenced to 6 years in prison, banned from making films, writing scripts, giving interviews, and leaving the country for 20 years.
Who's banned from leaving the country?
Yeah, great. I'd be like, okay, if you hate him so much, like kick him out of the country. But no, then he was arrested again in 2022, after supporting fellow filmmakers Mohammad Rasulov and Mustafa Alamad.
Whoa. Sorry, just to confirm, did he spend all 6 years in prison?
I'm not entirely sure on that. He was basically arrested again in 22, and he spent another 7 months in Tehran prison after being released on bail. But he always continued to work, just covertly, like he just secretly keeps making these movies, and they're either like in his own apartment or in his own car or just kind of like secretly. And if you take that into account, that just makes this movie all the more meaningful.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that people know that before going into this movie, because he made movies before like Closed Curtain and Taxi Tehran.
Yeah. Wow.
And this one was also shot without state permission, so all like super on the down low.
So how did he even get this made? Or surely there are consequences for him for seeing how internationally acclaimed this film.
Yeah, I'm sure the Iranian government found out. Yeah. I don't know. I would love to hear more about it. Even not knowing that, it is an incredible movie because what it does is it shows you this guy who is incredibly traumatized. He wants to kidnap and he wants to take vengeance on this guy. But then he goes and talks to all these other people who have memories from being captured by the state. And the more he talks to them, you realize that everyone with these traumas kind of deals with it in a different way. Like one guy like really wants vengeance. He's like, get him, like show me the guy, like I'll beat him up right now.
Yeah.
And someone else is like, well, do we want to continue this cycle of violence? Because like, we're no better than them if we now kill this guy. Or throughout this quest of like finding whether or not this is the right guy, he meets all these new people, and they also share their own trauma from being imprisoned. So as a viewer, you get these little vignettes of their time in prison. And that sounds really heavy, and it is. And it's very like jarring to hear these accounts. But then also it's a comedy. It packages this in this kind of like, it's almost a heist movie or like a kind of like a comedy of errors. It just like does it in a way that's still like super funny also to watch and enjoyable. And I just have an infinite amount of respect for a filmmaker like this who can treat material like this in a way that still feels light for viewers, for who this is most important to see. Because I feel like there's a lot of movies about like war trauma, but a lot of people won't go see those because they're like, well, I don't want to have a bad time at the movie. So I think the way this movie was made makes it more accessible to a bigger audience and will hopefully garner enough enthusiasm from people who see it to get other people to see it. So it's a little bit like a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down, where you do learn about Iran and the things going on there. But it's still an incredibly enjoyable movie. I highly recommend it. It's really great. I'm really glad this won the Palme d'Or.
Sold it very, very well. I think I have to see this. Because I know he has, because we're showing a mini retrospective of his films currently at Lab. Mm-hmm. And there's one called Taxi Tehran, which is basically just him driving a taxi. And he puts the phone, I think, to film. And then he just has conversations with passengers that he picks up, often about society in Iran as well, which is a very simple idea, but very personal or easy window into life under a regime and this kind of thing. So,
yeah,
super curious about this one. It was just an accident.
It's really great. We will be screening that one at Lab, along with the other two we've talked about. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF.